We are live.
Okay, here we are live again. This is episode seven.
I think it's six.
Six or seven? Six. Okay, episode six. I never keep up with it. Episode six of this disaster that we call the Swoley Trinity.
The number of the beast. This should be an evil one.
Yeah. And we have our first. It took us all of 12 weeks to get a first guest on. And I think we can speak for all of us. We'll say we're very elated to have St. Brad Schoenfeld on today. It's Alan Appley. Thanks for coming on today, Brad. We really appreciate it, bud.
My pleasure, guys.
So, and as usual, I'm here with Alan Arrogant. And,
yeah, that's me.
Yeah, and Dr. Scott Stevenson. What's up, Scott?
What do you call him, Scott Stevenson?
There we go. Finally, it's an anomaly.
Because he gets irritated with you consistently calling him David Koresh. So I was going to be nice and open up by actually calling him with his real name.
Now, Paul, right. You're throwing me for a loop. Now I'm really scared.
Look, I'll let it slide just once.
I'm getting baited in here on something. I can tell.
No. Okay.
Yeah, that's what they all say.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Brad, for anybody who happens to watch this that doesn't know your work, I'd also like to point out that Brad is in academia, Alan. It's something you wish you were in.
Right. I'm not an academic because I don't work at a university.
Brad, tell us, dude, just like high level overview. I know everybody hates bios because it feels like, you know, I know it does for me when somebody's like, tell us what you've done. High level overviews. Tell us anybody that's watching about yourself and your prominent work and stuff like that. Because like I said, we're all excited to have you on to talk about the sciencey shit. So and you're the man for that. So get into it.
Kind of the 60-second version. I was a personal trainer for many years. I specialized in training physique athletes, a lot of female fitness and figure competitors, as well as bodybuilders. And gradually over the years progressed to becoming an educator, researcher. I currently am the program director for the graduate program at Lehman College in human performance. I published now over 200 peer-reviewed papers. My primary research focus is on muscle development and body fat. Body composition, really body fat loss, and do a lot of speaking. And really, I consider myself my primary focus is as an educator, trying to dispel myths and to educate people on evidence-based practice.
Love it, dude. And I'd like to point out for anybody that wants to troll me that watches this, I fully acknowledge that I am one of these things is not like the other. So we got two PhDs on here and one guy that wishes he was in academia and Alan who only has a master's degree. And I don't have a degree in anything except being a bro. So I try to call myself the kind of the conduit. Alan loves the conduit between the meathead bros and, you know, you the research, you know, evidence based guys. But one of the things I want to compliment you on, and I'm not an ass. I think everybody knows here. I'm not an ass kisser. But one of the things I want to compliment you on, Brad, is that you do, I think, a really great job of emphasizing when you use the term evidence-based that it encompasses a multitude of things. And so I want you to touch on that because that's going to be at the heart of like what we talk about today is bridging that gap between what we see happening in the field and then what you guys are seeing out of research and from data. So to me, when I hear evidence-based, it always comes back to you've put up graphs about this before, which I still have some of those because I'm like, okay, yes, this makes sense to me. But when you say evidence-based, what does evidence-based mean to you?
So I'll start with what evidence-based is not, and that is not just simply deferring to research. Evidence-based really is a three-pronged approach. So it takes the overall evidence that we know from the peer-reviewed literature, which is people who dismiss that, thinking that that's just white lab coat stuff, are really missing the boat, and I'll get to that in a minute. But it's combining that with practical experience and the needs in the individual, the needs and the abilities of the individual. So here's the issue. Number one, people that dismiss science, just white lab coat stuff, I kind of equate this to going out. You guys ever deep sea fish? No?
Yeah, I have. Yes. I grew up in Louisiana, yeah.
So if you go deep sea fishing, do you just go out and drop your line somewhere? No, you're going to go out, you're going to use sonar to try to find where the fish are. I equate research to finding where the fish are, or basically you're just fishing in the dark. And if you're fishing, you could be the best fisherman in the world. If you're fishing where there's no fish, you're not going to catch a fish. Research really is a controlled way. It's the scientific method. It allows you to get your biases out of the equation. So basically you can avoid confirmation bias, and true evidence-based practice at its highest level is as controlled as you possibly can get. So you're going to basically take, and hopefully if you can get to this, two groups, you just manipulate one given variable that you're looking for an answer to. And if you can control all the other variables, you can then isolate whether there is an effect or there isn't an effect. So that ultimately is our gold standard for determining causality of a topic. Now, with that said, there's many holes in research. And you got, first of all, in any exercise-based program, unless you're going to, which good luck with this, you're going to get a metabolic ward, or you're going to have people, let's say a group of bodybuilders sheltered on an island, and you're going to give them their food every day, you're going to control their sleep, you're going to control their activity, you're never going to control all the extraneous factors. So you, there's certain things you're going to have to take for granted, and there's going to be biologic variability within that. And there's just gaps in terms of how much each study is going to have certain inherent biases in terms of how they're carried out by the researchers, how much supervision they're given. Like, this is something a lot of people don't know who don't do research. Like, every one of my studies is personally supervised. So each subject will get a research assistant that takes them through their workout. There's a lot of studies, and it's not that this is necessarily a deal breaker, but they'll have a group of subjects come in, they'll have four or five subjects, and they'll train them in a circuit where they're going around. And that, of course, you're not able then to exert as much control over what they're doing, how hard they're pushing, and other factors. And here's the most important point. There's huge individual variability in responses. So every time I do a study, we're going to report the means of a study, what the average values are. But you're going to, let's say in muscle growth, you're going to see some people got 20, 25% muscle growth, and you're going to see others got zero or even lost some muscle. And it just shows how variable, and there's been studies on this, that show huge variability in responses. So bottom line, what I would say is that it's this three-pronged approach, in my long-winded way, that you're going to take research and use that as a general guideline. And it's not – the other thing that people tend to do, and I get this with my studies all the time, and I try to temper people, but one study is just a piece of a puzzle. There's no study that people hold up, oh, my God, the study came out. No, every study you have to understand has limitations that you could just – there's variations in chance that results came out a certain way. So you look at the body of literature. You try to look at the overall body, and that takes time to develop a large body of literature to have strong confidence in those conclusions. That will give you that starting point. That's your sonar to know where your fish are. Then you're going to use your own expertise, and you're going to take into account the needs and abilities of the individual, because basically this will give you a starting point or a general starting point that you're going to then go up or down with based upon how they're responding. And that is the true evidence-based practitioner is going to understand these things. Guys like you all have years and years of experience in the field, as I do. And you'll use that experience, and you're going to know who you're training. And look, within that, that's why evidence-based is specific to the person who's carrying it out, because based on our own biases of expertise, we're going to have different approaches. And there'll be mostly commonalities, I would think, in our approaches, but there'll be certain things that you might do based on things that you've seen and done and experienced in the gym that I would do differently based on my own experiences. So kind of that's in a nutshell where evidence-based practice is, and hopefully that clarifies that it is not just simply deferring to research.
Yeah, dude, that was an amazing, amazing way of putting it. And like you covered pretty much all the bases. And I think the part there that I've hit on when I've had these discussions with people online is the key words you said there was that it's a guideline, right? It's a starting point where you're looking, okay, this is the guideline. And the way I like to phrase it, I'm like, hey, it's data is a guideline. It's not a Dick's lab. So it's like, you're like, okay, this is the data that we had that kind of give us a general direction. And then from there, it's like you talked about the needs of an individual. It gets kind of massaged or manipulated based on everything from lifestyle factors to movement selection to a multitude of things. And what I would consider a good coach does is brings all of those variables into account on an individual basis, like we talked about, to make that the most optimal way to either train or diet or whatever for those people. And that's the way that you mix that cocktail up to make it most optimal on an individual type basis.
Excellent summary. And I'll give you one other thing. You also have to look at the generalizability of the findings, meaning that who were the populations that are studied and who are you training? So there is a virtual paucity. There's virtually zero, I shouldn't say zero because we've actually carried out a few, but almost no studies have been carried out in well-trained bodybuilders. So when we say we carried out studies in resistance-trained men, this is the majority of my research, yeah, they have two, three, four, generally somewhere between 2 and 4 or 5 years of experience, but they're not people, they're not guys like you, you know? They're people that are trained, they've been resistance trained, so they're not getting newbie gains. But when you're at a very high level, number one, you're closer to your genetic ceiling, which is going to have effects there. And number two, there's other factors you're able to push. Someone like you is going to push a lot harder. You're going to have a certain, I mean, I've trained, I know both of you guys have, and I'm not sure with you, Alan, but trained with John Meadows. I mean, the level of intensity when you train with a pro bodybuilder, I'm currently working with a IFBB Classic Physique pro now. And I mean, it's insane. And he's 47 years old. And I mean, he could take every set. I have to pull him back from overdoing it. Like, he wants to take every set, not only the failure, but then get 4 straps. And when my training with him, I'm like, Joe, you gotta save some, leave some in the tank. You know, you're going to be spent. You're going to get overtrained. It's trying to pull him back from, but his capacity to recuperate is just incredible based upon number one, genetics, and I assume a long term of training. So again, I want to belabor the point, but you have to really look at the individual and take that into account as well. And based on the research, if you're doing a study in 80-year-old nursing home subjects and female nursing home subjects, they're not necessarily going to apply well to a 22-year-old football player with 3-4 years of training experience, or certainly a bodybuilder.
Right. No, that's an absolutely great point. I'm glad that you pointed that out too, because a lot of times if you guys end up with, say, you know, 25 or 20 subjects for a study, and they're college age kids and they have a relative low degree of like life stress, then the type of training they might be doing, say, over the 8 or 10 or 12 weeks in that study might not be applicable at all. It might not be practical for a guy who, say, is like 42, has been training for like 10 years and is like a CEO of a company, is working like 60 hours a week and is consistently stressed out. So, and that comes back to what you said in the evidence-based field. You have to bring in the needs of an individual, what they can tolerate, what they can't tolerate, and all the other multitude of factors, and then you massage it out from there.
So important.
Yeah. So let's get into what I think we all kind of agree, like what we want to talk a little bit about today is bridging some of those factors. So anybody that watches this can come away, because one of the things we like to do with our podcast is actually give information somebody can watch and say, okay, so let me manipulate this variable in my diet, or manipulate this variable in my training or lifestyle or supplementation or whatever, you know, and kind of, so we want to separate this podcast from other podcasts. I think, not saying we're better, we are better, but I'm not saying that. But my point is that we want to be able to give people something tangible that they can leave with. So I think today, with having you on, the one of the things that we kind of all agreed on was kind of bridging some of those gaps in between what we see coming out of research and data, and then looking kind of at real world stuff, and pick your brain a little bit about what you think of both. Now, I think one of the reasons why you have a much more broad approach about this than a lot of guys who just delve into the data, into studies and that kind of stuff, is that you did come from a background of training people, and you have had the in the field experience and know that that's relevant too. And I think that separates or what a lot of those guys, and you probably have seen this too, from a lot of the guys who don't have that experience, and then they're consistently relying on research, kind of fail to understand the ability or the need to apply that particular knowledge subset in with everything else to make it more complete. So,
and I just to address that too, it's a really great point that I think that's one of the main reasons that my research has gotten so much play and so much popularity, is that I'm the kid in the candy store now, because I was a personal trainer for almost 18 years over the course of a very long period. I started when I was 7. That's why I look so young. But that was a joke. But
I got it.
Really, everything that I was going through as a personal trainer, I started looking into the research and saying, geez, there are all these things I want to know, and there's no real research on it. So basically, once I got to be a researcher, it's like kid in the candy store. I want to research this, and I have so many things I wish, hopefully we're developing now a master's program, and I'll have a doctoral program at some point soon. And we can really start to then, as productive as I've been, especially in collaborating. I mean, there's just so many topics that are understudied, and you really need to be a practitioner, I think, to get a true sense of what needs to be done and what these gaps are. Or certainly I think it helps a lot.
Yeah. And so, and that's a huge, we're actually, one of the questions on is like some of the fields that you think are understudied. Like, for example, I'd love to see a study done, like one group of guys, like, you know, smashing like a gram of Tren a week and like a 2 grams test. And, cause I like, despite what the internet says about, like, I don't take Tren, and I've like, the longest I ever ran a Tren cycle was 8 days. I've always been very open. No matter how open you are about your like drug use, like people still call you a liar. Like I legitimately just take a replacement dose of testosterone anymore. And people are like, that's bullshit. You're lying. I'm like, I don't know what to tell you anymore. Like Dorian Yates came out and has been open about his cycle for like the last 10 years. People are like, he's lying. I'm like, I don't know what point he has to lie about this anymore. But yeah, you guys need to do some research on guys smashing some androgens compared to guys that are natty.
There's a little thing called an IRB, an institutional review board, that kind of doesn't look favorably.
I know. I just think it would be – how great would it be to be able to test guys using different androgens over the course of, like
– You might want to go to, like, maybe Russia. You might be able to pull that off. I don't know. Yeah. They might have some loose IRB standards these days. I don't know.
Bazin, get in touch with Bazin. He'll hook you up.
That's actually, well, we had the one study what they gets referenced from years ago was when the guys were the using 600 milligrams of test. We talked about that, where they didn't do anything and grew more muscle than the natural group of guys that were training. That's the one that always gets referenced out.
I have no idea how they got that past IRB. And that, by the way, that's not even that high. I mean, for what bodybuilders do, that would be considered a very modest cycle.
Well, but that's even pretty much natural. It's pretty much natural.
I was going to say, Brad, that's actually HRT. Really, that's just natural anymore. That's a natural dose of testosterone. I don't know what you're talking about. You have to get to a gram before you're actually using steroids. I don't know if anyone's filled you in on this information.
It's the gram rule, yeah.
Until you get to a gram, like, it has to be at least a gram total. So you could do, like, 600 milligrams of test, but you better throw in, like, another 400 of, like, NPP or DECA or something like that. It has to be a gram up until, like, a gram and anything over a gram is now actually using steroids. But anything a gram is pretty much natural, anything under a gram.
That's a new rule.
Is that the Carter rule?
That's not my rule. Like, that was the internet made that rule up a long time ago.
You're the messenger here. Yep. You don't make the laws, you just report them.
The magistrate.
I want to get into some of the questions. I think, Scott, did you come up with these or did you, Alan? Who came up?
I did. I came up.
Alan. Okay, Alan, you did a good job here, homie.
Thank you.
Since I've been talking this whole time, I'm gonna you take the first one and ask Brad, and you guys do the back.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk the whole time.
I want to put a different slant on this first question. I was gonna ask just something real general, but I want to ask some pretty specific. So there's a couple of meta analyses that came out by Barbalho and colleagues. First, one looking at women and one looking at men.
That wasn't a meta analysis. That was a study.
Was it a study?
Yeah, it was just a study.
Both of them were studies, right?
They had two. They had the one they did that was 24 weeks long with the women, and then one they did that was 24 weeks long with the men. But they were virtually identical in methodology, outside of the fact that in the men's study, there was a midpoint halfway through the study where they looked at the data again.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm screwing up my.
Dude, I talked to you the first question. You shit all over it right out of the gate.
I know. I know, dude. Look, I'm a nutrition guy, right? So,
you want to give this one to Scott since you're messing up?
No way, dude. I'm on a roll here.
Get back on your war horse.
So they came down with like roughly 5 to 10 sets being kind of the takeaway, and. There seems to be a discrepancy with some of the recent research, Brad, that you've done. And what do you think might account for those differences methodologically or not? Because those are kind of those are sort of the comparisons that people draw between Krieger Schoenfeld camp versus, you know, let's say Barbalho and Gentile, et cetera. You're almost like two two sides of the continuum in a sense. So how do you account for those differences?
So I'll start off by saying I don't have a camp. I carry out a study. I report the research. I don't. If I do the study again, it comes out different. I report whatever the results are. So I don't have a camp. I try to look at, like we talked about earlier, at what the body of literature shows and then draw a conclusion. So it's I know people have kind of used those types of terms, and I think it's important to make that distinction because we do a study. And by the way, in the study that we carried out on the topic, it was contrary to both my hypotheses for both outcomes. Strength, we showed no difference. You actually showed a U-curve where the one set had greater results than the three sets, and then the five sets had equal results to the one set. So really nothing there. And we showed this dose-response relationship with hypertrophy, on the other hand. I had envisioned that the three-set group would do as well as five sets. And it's always been my, you can look, it's funny, I published a, funny but ironic, I published a paper about 3 months before we published these results, before these results actually came out, the data came out, and my, I published this with another colleague, that the hypothesis was, is that somewhere between 10 to 20 sets or so is your optimal training volume for a week, for a muscle. So both of those were disproven by the, or they did not pan out in the study we had. When you're asking what discrepancies are, so number one, their study was 6 months. The second one, they did a 12-week, a retest after 12 weeks. Our study was 8 weeks. So that could be a factor that, I mean, one thing that I've always felt, and just from evidence-based practice, from my own personal expertise, is that you can't push volume for long periods of time, high volumes. And usually I don't do it for more than 4 to 6 weeks. And sometimes six would even be pushing it a little high. So usually like 3 to 4 is kind of my general where I go with the very high, when I say very high, the higher levels. So could it be that it started, maybe if they had an 8 week test or so, it would have been different. I don't know. The other thing they did, they used a bro split where we did a total body routine. So we spaced out the volume over a period of time, and they basically mashed all their volume into one session, into single sessions, like similar to bodybuilding training. There is some evidence from our recent frequency meta showing that there would be a benefit to spacing out volume, that once you get to a certain volume, it just doesn't, adding on more volume in a given session doesn't seem to produce greater results. But here's the other thing I'll say, is that their results are contrary to really the vast majority of the other literature showing a dose response. Our study was a replication study of another Brazilian study carried out by Radielli, Robert Samau's lab. And they actually, and here's the other issue when I say that, could it be overtraining over the course of 6 months? It could, but the study that we replicated, Radielli's study, was a six-month study. And they showed massive gains. They showed more than double the results for the highest volume group. The 5-3-1, basically our study was very similar. We tried to replicate it in many ways, except in a shorter time frame. Now, their subjects were not Marines. They were Navy. They were military personnel on a Navy ship. So first of all, the kind of cool thing is that they kept them contained. So they were able to control. You talk about control of variables. It's one of the better controlled studies because you feed them, you're giving them foods. They're, I don't know how, what their capacity for sneaking other foods are.
I'm not sure I understand.
My phone is kind of going out of me here, so I don't know what's going on here. But so that could be a factor that maybe they, because their military personnel had greater recuperative abilities, but they again showed in their 6 months, it was double, more than, it was triple the amount of time.
Healthy.
They showed almost triple the results.
Healthy user bias. Healthy user bias. I'm just going to say healthy user bias. That's an inside joke between us.
Okay. And look, there's many other studies. There's a new study now that I'm not sure whether it's been published, but it's online. They've published the pre-pub of it, which is carried out in Norway. And it's a really cool design where they did, they looked at 5 sets versus 15 sets. Now, they didn't do a middle group like 10 sets, so it's tough to know. But it was So within subject design, now these were untrained subjects, so you got to take that into account, whereas it was trained subjects, but they did 15 sets versus 5. They did one leg. They randomized legs. So basically you're taking that into individual variability. They showed greater growth, and they used MRI as their measure. They showed greater increases in ribosome biogenesis, which is a marker to increase growth. You need to increase ribosome biogenesis. They showed increases in muscle protein synthesis on a on an acute level in the highest versus the low. So they looked at multiple, this is called triangulation of evidence, when you get multiple evidence showing a similar pattern towards a given outcome, that it tends to support an outcome. So again, I'm people kind of think that I'm this volume guy. I'm fine with if the literature starts showing otherwise, but we published a meta-analysis that was 15 studies on the topic. And if you look at the scatter plots or the forest plots of the individual studies, there was one study in elderly 70-year-old elderly women that had a very slight effect for the lower volume. Every other study was either equal or greater results favoring the lower volume. So I don't think there's any certainly there is no doubt that volume is a mediator of anyone that would dispute that. I think I don't know what research they're looking at, but here's the thing that I would say. And I think in our study, we hopefully will be publishing these results at some point. I think the biggest take home, and I'd say two things. One of the real big takeaways that people really miss here, this is not a ours was not a training study to say how many sets should you train per muscle per week. That was not the goal of our study. And anyone that would extrapolate, you can only extrapolate results to what was done in the study. So our study was 3 days a week. The subjects in the highest volume group trained for 70 minutes. Now, I don't know what your guys' training time is, but virtually every bodybuilder I know is training a lot more than that in terms of the time that they're putting in. So we condensed these workouts to basically just legs and chest exercise, shoulder exercise. So they were very kind of bare bones. They were not bodybuilding workouts. We wanted to isolate this to say, could there be a benefit to training a given muscle group with more volume versus another? Not all the muscle groups. So anyone that understands the application of research understands that in no way would you extrapolate this out and say you do very high volumes for all your muscle groups, because the overtraining response is systemic. It's based on the total volume that you're doing of everything. So you'd have to spend 15 hours in the gym to do, if you parceled that out in bodybuilding terms, if you wanted to try to extrapolate those things, and that would be silly. It would just not be, I don't think anyone in their right mind would advocate that as a viable way to extrapolate results.
But the problem with that, though, Brad, is, and I'm sure you see it, that does happen.
Well, I can only do a study. It shouldn't happen in terms of, from my educational standards, is that I've repeatedly stated this. So people can, that is one of the problems with the internet. Internet's been a great thing for everyone, but it has a real downside, is that you get these abstract researchers who they're in their armchair like I am now, and they're reading an abstract and saying, oh, volume, doing a lot of volume.
We have a term for that. So I think it was the last podcast, we determined that there were bro science levels of guys online. There was, what was it? We called it PubMed levels of guys online. So like a bro science, like a five level bro science guy is a guy that can really get awesome results and knows how to train people, knows how to diet people, that kind of stuff, but isn't always quite on with, like, particularly the mechanisms as why that happens. It's kind of a, and I think Alan likes to use Chris Aceto as like a five level bro science guy. And then
like a four
low level PubMed guy is just a guy that throws abstracts out at people and goes, well, this study says this, and he's not bothering to read if the study has practical applications to, say, the Gen Pop, right, or whatever you're looking at, and say, okay, well, when you're looking at it from an application standpoint of who's going to go in and do this on a day in and day out basis, is it applicable to the majority of people? And that's really relevant when you're looking at how the study is actually performed or conducted. And that's a huge part that gets missed in this. And I know you deal with this on an everyday basis because you post a lot of great content. And then the comments that you get underneath that oftentimes, I know, like, you're not going to say it because you're a nice dude, but I'm like, I think I've told you that before. It's like, dude, I don't know how you wake up every day without strangling one person before noon is like some of the concepts, because you put together a study and somebody always says something to the effect of, well, why didn't you do it using this one thing? Yeah, I can see the look on your face. Well, why didn't you do this? Or I'd like to see it done this specific way. And I'm sure you would too, but there's only so much time in a day. There's only so much, so many resources available to anyone performing a study as well. So you can't possibly cover every facet of that. But I think the point I want to get back to you was like understanding the practicality of the data, right? That's a huge point.
Exactly. So that really, and this is the issue. And you can do what you can to try to educate people, but people are going to do what people are going to do. And you can only generalize and extrapolate from a study what the study shows. So again, there were seven exercises. The total volume in sets for the entire week was around 100 sets in the high. So we did one set, three set, five sets. And the highest group did like 100 sets total for 8 weeks, which by any standards, by most, that's parceled out over the entire, in the entire week. So here's what my takeaway, for what it's worth, from the study is looking at the inter-individual responses. And this is something we're hoping to, we just have to figure out the best way to statistically analyze that. But we've done statistical analysis based on what's called a smallest worthwhile change, which simply stated is what you would consider the minimal effect that a given outcome would have to produce something that you'd consider meaningful. And the interesting thing with this, there were people in the lowest volume group that got really robust results. So again, the data were all over the place, but the number of poor responders was less in the higher volume groups than there were in the lower groups. Meaning that if someone is a poor responder, you might want to say, hey, volume is something that you want to mediate, that you want to manipulate to increase their potentially increase the results. And by the way, could it go the other way? It could, but these results seem to suggest otherwise, that most people who maybe not are getting results might benefit from more volume. That would be one takeaway I'd have. And the other takeaway that I'd have is that there might be a benefit towards training a lagging muscle group with higher volumes. And this is something that I've now started experimenting with, as have my colleagues like James Krieger and some other ones in our practical we have to see, but I've been doing this with the bodybuilder that I'm working with, where we isolate, let's say, his side delts and his hamstrings were lagging points. And we're going to, for those muscle groups, I'm training them first in his workout, and I'm increasing the volume. So we're doing more frequency, so I'm spreading out more greater frequency. We'll have an extra hamstring day. It's not just putting more volume into the given workout. It's giving him extra days of hamstring work, which will total out to more volume across a week, and trying to bring up that muscle group. And we have some picks, and it seemed to be effective.
So basically putting guys in like a maintenance mode for certain body parts, and then like...
Exactly.
So, just to
expand on that, you have a certain... So this kind of goes where I'm saying there's going to be a certain amount of volume that you can do for your entire body. Factor in all the sets you're doing. Let's say that's 100 sets. Let's say it's 120 sets, whatever it is. Say it's 80 sets. Within that, how are you going to disperse your volume to achieve what you're looking to do? And here's the other important factor. Studies are not forever. It's not like a year, 2 years. You look at it in short blocks. That's the way I think training for at least elite people, people that really want to optimize their results should be looked at. You look at short blocks. You don't need to train high volume all the time or low volume all the time. You could do some lower, some higher. You can do high reps. You can do low reps. You could do some short reps. Training should not necessarily be a binary dichotomous decision. That you and in general, that's the way that any good bodybuilder trains, is that they're constantly maneuvering, they're constantly manipulating what they're doing to bring about greater effects over time. And the good evidence-based practitioners are going to have hopefully a advantage there if they can understand and synthesize research properly.
Yeah. So based on the combination of what you've seen from all the research that you've been involved with and that you've read and you've poured over, and then in combination with what you've seen in the field, I think it's safe to say that we kind of do understand that there's an inverse of U curve related to volume, right, as well. It's like it's one of the drivers up to a point, and then from there, what we see, it's a point of diminishing returns. You're not getting anything extra from doing more work.
Absolutely.
So if you were to advise guys, and I think that was the other point I wanted to hit on before, is like when it's a completely different subject. We're talking whether or not somebody, natty guys need different training protocols and enhanced guys. As far as we know, as I know, all the guys your subjects are all natty guys. So based on the almost two decades of work that you did in the field combined with all the research work that you've done, what's kind of the range that you see that appears to be most optimal that gives a guideline for people to be working in as far as sets per week in terms of working sets, not including warm-ups, but like working sets that are actually taken to muscular failure or like very close to muscular failure?
So, well, that's a little bit hard because I think that is another individual. Training to failure is kind of a real touchy subject in terms. Some people are able to recover much better than others. I certainly don't think failure should be in all. I'm not trying to skirt your question because I'll come back to it, but I like to use an RIR, repetitions in reserve, where some sets, I think most sets should be close to failure within a couple reps for failure. But going to all out failure, my general recommendations are most people should not do that really more than the last set of each exercise.
And I think also I think for most people that are watching this, we need to like apply, I think, what I consider proper context to there, right? Because, for example, I don't think there's any reason to ever avoid leaving reps in reserve from, say, side laterals or triceps pushdowns. They're not very neurally taxing. Exactly. But if you're talking about once you get into your compound movements that have a high degree of neural taxation involved with them, exactly, like squats or deadlifts or leg press, then Scott and I have talked about this many times that we agree you set either form failure or a failure set point that you know is failure for you. But if you actually, you know, went to where like where you're squatting, you know, to where you literally can't, you end up with the bar on the rails and that's true muscular failure. You don't really need to train to that type of muscular failure in squats to get the type of stimulus needed for adaptation to cause growth. So it's important that when guys talk about training to failure, it's not some blanket statement. We have to use it in the right context, right? So like if I'm doing curls, like it's probably pretty okay for me to take curls to true muscular failure. I'm probably not going to have a tough time recovering systemically from doing that. But if I'm doing a set of squats, probably okay. I'm going to get a good growth response off leaving two reps, maybe even three reps in the tank. If I'm doing 12 or 15 rep sets that are really hard, create a tremendous amount of metabolic stress and are going to create that need, that stimulus for growth, that response that you're looking for. So that's all context too, right?
Totally agree. That is such a great point. And look, no one does a set of side laterals and say, I'm crushed. Oh my God, I went to failure in side laterals on four sets. Man, I can't wash my hair now or anything. And here's another, by the way, another real, I think, salient point here is that in our paper, and I think in most of the studies on the topic, the subjects are trained to failure. So that actually, to me, could be an issue. And why do we do that? It's not because we think that's the best training way to train. It's that it takes confounding out of it. Because if I were to say, let's use an RIR, people's concepts of RIR are different. And then people could say, well, you had them train to RIR. And why did the one set group train to failure here? It starts. So we just figure everyone's going to train to failure. That way, it's not a variable that can be considered a confounding issue. But from a practical standpoint, when you're talking ecological validity, I could perhaps surmise if we had them back off more, could they have gotten better growth from more volume? I mean, it's possible. Unless you would do that, there's no way to know.
This is going to come out of my mouth. That swings both ways, right? Because it comes back to the individual variability between people. Because the one guy, like he might have seen better results by leaving two reps in the tank. And then the other guy might have seen better results by absolutely smashing himself on those. And that's why I tell guys, I'm like,
absolutely.
Guys ask me questions online. I always tell them, it's like, you're going to have to do some experimentation in the gym on yourself to figure out the feedback that you get. Like a lot of people, they just want answers. And like, you can't possibly have all the answers for every person. I tell guys, why don't you go try this and figure out some of these variables and what actually works best for you?
Hey guys, why are you using sports nutrition that was designed for someone else? At TrueNutrition.com, they offer the world's largest selection of quality protein powders, and they let you design your own custom blend from a variety of powders, flavors, boosts, and packaging options, like the Team Skip blend, for instance. That's over 20 billion possible combinations to create a protein powder tailored to your diet, your goals, your tastes, and your budget. TrueNutrition.com also offers the ability to create delicious custom oatmeal blends. And they're third-party tested, proving that all their supplements are ensured to have the highest level of quality and value. Don't be a sucker and pay for fancy packaging and gimmicks. Discover the source that bodybuilders trust and stop using mass-produced nutrition that wasn't designed for you. TrueNutrition.com. And use our code ADVICES at checkout to let them know that you support the shows.
Yes,
we lost everybody there. So pick up where you were, Brad. Just repeat all that crap again.
There was a study out of Marcus Bannon's lab at the University of Alabama where they ended up doing what's called a cluster analysis, where they looked to see the good high responders, moderate responders, and poor responders to exercise. They put 66 subjects through a leg program, lower body training program, that was 27 sets a week. So it was three sets of leg press, three sets of squats, and three sets of leg extensions, all to failure. 3 days a week, so 27 sets per muscle per week. And it was roughly half elderly, half young, half men, half women. And so one of the real interesting findings that really is not reported, but if you look at the data, this is something that just stuck out at me, that out of the young male subjects, only one of the young subjects was in the poor response. All the other subjects, 15, average of 1% growth across the cross-sectional area, or 50% growth over the course of the study. Whereas the elderly subjects, many of the subjects were in the poor responder category. So it shows that memory is an issue, especially as you get older, and that's something I would take from that.
Is Scott, you still here? McNally?
Yeah, he'll still be here.
He's still here? Okay. Yeah. I just saw him disappear from the screen. So
yeah, that's normal. That's normal, Alan. We do that every time.
I'm paranoid now, man. Years. Okay. Go ahead, man.
That's the point. I don't want to leave that out there, the Brad hit on the end. And that is something I've also tried to address that we roughly brushed over earlier. I said when I was in my teens and 20s, I could train far more often with an effort that was like ridiculous and train 5, 6, sometimes 7 days a week during that time if I wanted, and I still felt fine. And there's absolutely no way I can still do that now at 44 and recover from it for a multitude of reasons. I can generate a higher degree of effort, be more efficient with my movements. My focus is better. My biomechanics are better. But aside from that, the aging process too, right? You just don't recover. You're not going to recover as faster when you start to get into your 40s. And we could talk about that for hours, but I just do want to look over that. And that's what we kind of talked about earlier, was that law of individuality that's needed too, when you're looking, and that's why it's important for people not to paint broad strokes with studies and actually look at the practical application of the age of the subjects, what they're doing with their life, all those kind of things. Say, hey, is this even something? And like you said, you're looking at what the study's presenting, not necessarily always saying, hey, guys, go out and particularly train this way for the results you're looking for. You're looking for a certain type of feedback with what you're doing.
I don't know what you mean by feedback, but I'm looking to answer. Each study is going to try to answer a question. Our question here was, for a given muscle group, is there a dose response relationship?
Right.
Do you keep getting, or are we going to, I had kind of expected based on my previous, what I published previously, that we'd start to see this measuring out. And by the way, we did in the upper body exercise, particularly the triceps, there was not that much difference in the between 3 and 5. It was, I would say, minor. So it kind of did kind of even out somewhat, where it certainly wasn't a big difference. It was here's the other thing. It was the results were bigger in the lower body than they were in the upper body. Now, we didn't do any – these are, again, things that you have to look at. We didn't do any isolated single joint exercises for the triceps. How would that have affected
you
things?
You just posted up one. What was it, yesterday or 2 days ago? Was looking at
– greater growth.
Where you're using single joint movements. And there were people all pissed off about that too. I'm like, guys, that should make sense to you. Like just from a, just a real life standpoint, like if you're getting a muscle fully lengthened and fully shortened and biasing it through an isolation movement, it's probably going to have more growth than if it's just working as a secondary or tertiary mover in a movement. Right. That, I just feel like that feels like common sense and something we've seen, as you said, like in the field over and over again for decades.
And one last thing on this, and hopefully we'll move on, but the other thing that I think is really important, so for bros like us and people who are bodybuilders, this is, to me, important information in terms of manipulation. For your average gym goer, I've said this always, and certainly my thoughts haven't changed. The average guy that came to me as a personal trainer and said, yeah, I want to tone up, I want to get some muscle on me, a very low-volume approach. I mean, training minimally, the types of – virtually, certainly on an average level, most of the people got results in the lower volume. And if you manipulate things properly, there's no reason that you need to spend more than an hour and a half, you know, three half-hour sessions. You can get very nice muscle development. You can get a lot stronger from a real minimalist type routine. What we're talking about here is those who want to take their physique to its optimal level. That's always been, as a personal trainer, that was one of my hobby horses. And that's kind of, as a bro, I was a bodybuilder, natty bodybuilder, and that kind of has driven my focus. I came from being a really skinny kid to having bodybuilding literally change my life, and that's been my focus to say, how can you maximize your genetic potential? Most people are not looking to maximize their genetic potential. So that needs to be considered.
Again, it comes back to maximizing your genetic potential is about getting in and having periods of experimentation. That's part of, like I said, I think that a lot of the people who look at the data, like you talked about, and look at it in isolation and try to say, okay, this is correct, or they're not combining those other parts that we talked about earlier, is that what we see in the field, and then a lot of individuality, the individual needs, and they have to kind of be their own lifting scientists right in the gym and figure out what those individual needs are. And I think that's missing, like you said, from a lot of guys that just don't want to take the time. Because here's the thing, when you find a guy that has a significant degree of muscular development, without fail, unless they're a genetic anomaly, they're an outlier, they've usually been in the gym for decades on end, they've gone through a lot of trial and error on their own part to kind of figure out what works really well for them. And I think a lot of guys are incredibly impatient about that process just has to happen. Like I don't know of any other way around that. Then you're just going to have to do a lot of things that you figure out, hey, this doesn't work for me. It's kind of like dating, right? Like you end up having to date some people that you're like, I don't really like these kind of people. And you have to kind of get out there and date kind of people you don't like to figure out the kind of people you do like. So training is not a lot different in that regard.
Research provides guidelines. After that, everybody is an N equals one. So you're going to then take your research and say, let me see here's my guideline. All right, let's start on the lower end, see how I respond. Do I need more? Do I need less? Do I need higher reps, lower reps? Is there a benefit to combining? Those are all things that you need to, like you said, find out ultimately what works best for you based on what you know through peer-reviewed research.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I know that Dr. Koresh, we've been like holding him back for a little bit. I just have to get a couple questions out to you, Brad. I've been wanting to ask you this stuff. So Paulo Gentile and his group, they have, I think, one or two studies looking at the addition of training of the isolation work in the smaller muscle groups in addition to the compound stuff, and they didn't find any additional hypertrophy of training the isolation stuff in addition to the compound stuff. Now, in field observations, you would never work with a bodybuilder who's competing and saying, all right, we're just going to train, compound push, compound pull, and squat and whatnot, and maximize muscular development. However, there seems to be this divide between what Gentile is reporting versus what we see in the field. What do you think accounts for his lack of observation of additional benefit to the isolation stuff?
So a couple of things here. First of all, you have to look at, he didn't just look at, in general, there was a couple that did, but they used just circumference. So all right, let me go here. Number one, most of the studies they've done have just looked at circumference measurements, where you basically take a tape measure and put it around the arm. It's a very crude measurement, and I would not expect in a short-term study that you would be able, with that type of measure, to actually see much in the way of growth. I would say the ability to accurately determine changes is very low with that type of measurement. They did have two studies that did use ultrasound, and neither of them showed a benefit. Number one, both of them were specific to the biceps, so we don't know, you can't necessarily extrapolate that to other muscles like the triceps or even the legs, let's say with a leg extension, or hamstrings with a hamstring curl. But here's the other, I think, thing that's important. How much volume then did you need? So you do a certain amount of volume. Is adding on more sets in the studies that actually looked at this, does adding on more sets of isolated exercises and have further benefit to that? That's a question that still needs to be answered. So it could be that they reached a volume limit, at least in the ones that did the ultrasound. I again, kind of dismiss the circumference measurements. I will say this. There was a study, Paul just mentioned it, that just came out a couple of days ago by colleagues of mine in Brazil. They looked at just doing bicep curls. I'm sorry, just looking at just doing bicep curls versus just doing rows. And they found roughly double the growth in just doing biceps curls versus just doing your rows. I will give you somewhat of a scoop. I can't say too much because we're just getting this data out, but I'm involved with another study in collaboration with a group. And we did a similar type of protocol in the triceps and found substantially greater growth in the triceps with an isolation move, with a single joint move, than a compound move. So again, this research is in its preliminary stages. Like I mentioned before, one study is a piece of the puzzle. I would say that the quality of the evidence at this point is low. In most, they've done a lot of work, but most of it has been with these crude measures. Let's see what happens over time. And I think I think it's difficult to draw from the research good data. Here's what I would say. I don't think there's anyone that's been worked in the field knows that if you just do, a isolation type move like a bicep curl, that you're going to tend to get better growth over time than doing rows. Whether there is an added benefit and where that way, where that kind of fits in to, let's say you do a heavy back workout and you're doing 12 sets of back, and then you want to get your biceps jacked, you do 6 sets of biceps more, or do you need to do that? Those are questions that hard for me to give a good answer on.
I want to mention something that Paul brought up earlier, was that training to failure, its utility of taking it to failure versus leaving stuff in the tank can be body part specific, mm-hmm. right? It can be movement specific. So movement specific. So with the isolation stuff of the smaller muscles, Paul brought the example of the laterals for the delts. It's kind of silly to think that you can tax yourself to a meaningful degree if you take those to failure, for example. Versus, let's say, taking deadlifts to failure, right? You know, we did a paper in 2015 with Eric Helms and Peter Fishen and Cronin, where I think that's the only paper in the literature where it's actually mentioned that, look, training to failure, that has to be discussed on the basis of different movements. So so Paul, you bring that up. That's the only place in the literature I can think of where that's discussed. And I want to point that out. This is a paper. It's called Recommendations for Natural Bodybuilding Contest Preparation, Resistance, and Cardiovascular Training. Okay, it's in Journal of Sports Medicine and Physical Fitness. So this is a 2015 paper. I definitely recommend that people.
Wasn't I on that paper too? I think I was on that paper. Yeah.
Yeah. we pulled you in on that paper, and I actually threw that in, the little detail that doing freaking concentration curls in the mirror is different from, let's say, taking pull-ups to failure, right? So I threw that little detail in, and there's nowhere else in the literature I know of where people make that distinction. So my question to you, Brad, is there room in the research to look at what body parts respond differently to failure versus not? Is that
absolutely. There should be, you know, you'd have to figure out a way what's going to be your metric and how do you so let's say you're going to do squats to failure versus leg extensions to failure. What's going to be your metric? You're going to look at growth, first of all.
Subjects for weeks at a time that are actually going to like real failure on high rep squats. That's you're going to wipe out some guys pretty quickly with that.
So, but is your metric going to be what's their perceived exertion after the workout? Are you going to look at their actual growth? Because people can – the one thing that the human body has a really remarkable ability to endure, to be resilient. I mean, you go to people that are put in these war camps. I mean, they survive on eating bugs and things that you'd never think you could ever do. You know, where you hear people that are stranded in an island or something and they survive. So there's a difference between thriving or surviving. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you'd have to think about what the metrics are, but certainly I think that's an area that is really rife for research. And both of you guys, I think, made terrific points there.
Yeah, I think what would be more interesting for me, and that would be looking at, say, taking the same program where you're doing your big movements, like your squats, your barbell rows, you know, your chin-ups and doing all those things, even having one group that left X amount of reps in reserve, whereas the other group actually went to failure, then equating volume and frequency and all that kind of stuff. And then we would start, I feel like that give a more clear picture a little bit of about, because one of the things I try to emphasize to guys is that I don't really get overly concerned about localized muscle recovery. I get more concerned about systemic taxation. And what a program is doing to somebody systemically, because that's the neural taxation is what we have to really worry about. Scott does a really good job of emphasizing that. And I can't remember what quote he has, but I always accredit to him. It's like, if you're looking at sustainable long-term programming and results, you want to minimize the amount of neural taxation that's happening within a training program while maximizing the amount of muscular stress or tension that's going on. And that's where you can get into those, you can train for a long period of time without getting beat up or feeling like you're run down or you need a deload or that kind of stuff, because you're keeping the systemic taxation low. And that's where most guys, where they start feeling, where they call it like they have CNS burnout. They don't really understand, like the systemic taxation is where you actually have more trouble recovering from. The localized muscle recovery, you can be sore going and train the next day and you're not sore the day after that. And that's the kind of stuff that I would be far more interested as far as if you're looking at actually designing better programming for guys, looking at, okay, look, guys, when you're using it more, and I actually use this, my particular theory is that the more neurally taxating a movement is, which means the more intramuscular coordination has to go on in it, is that there's going to be a higher degree of systemic taxation involved, especially when you're pushing really hard on those particular movements. And that comes back, that's a more fancy way of saying, yeah, you can bust ass really hard on your side laterals and potentially even like your lat pull downs or your curls, your tricep extensions and stuff. But for your big movements that require a great deal of coordination, and you have to do a lot of internal bracing and create a lot of internal stability. Those movements, yeah, I even tell guys, like, I don't go to true muscular failure on those. If my low back is in a compromising position, for example, even if I'm doing barbell rows, no, I don't go true failure on those. Deadlifts, I don't do anymore at all because I hate deadlifting. But even like squats or stuff like that, I always pretty much leave a couple of reps in the tank of what I call like form failure, or that I know this is effort failure for me.
Ooh. And that's a great distinction, the systemic, but I think what some people seem to misunderstand, there's no evidence that there is overtraining of a given muscle group.
Right.
And really, overtraining is a systemic response. So you will see when we talk about an inverted U, it's the total volume. It's not like I do bicep curls and I'm just going to see this, you know, at some point it's going to drop off because it's overtraining from my biceps. It's a systemic effect of all the volume. And that's why, like the Barbalo study, it would seem to suggest, because they actually saw regression in everything, in hypertrophy and strength, which is, that's somewhat curious to me in that respect, because the only possible explanation is that they were systemically overtrained. You wouldn't just see that a inverted U response from continually training a given muscle group to that respect. So they would have ultimately, now they didn't do any hormonal markers or other, they didn't look at any other factors associated with overtraining, which would have been interesting. But that could be the only explanation, because there's no mechanism by which I know that you can overtrain a given muscle. And the only way you're going to get, so you're going to see a plateau. At a certain point, volume would increase. But when you start seeing the regression, it is because of a systemic response from doing too much. And that's, by the way, it's not only volume, but it's the interaction. And that's the other really important thing that everyone needs to be cognizant of, is that there's an interaction between variables, frequency, volume, repetition. So if you're doing low reps versus high reps, my dissertation study, we looked at a bodybuilding protocol versus a powerlifting protocol. So it was a 10 rep, three sets of 10. It was volume equated. So
yeah,
three sets of 10.
This is one of my most favorite studies, and not just by you, but of all time. That was one of my favorites.
Yeah, and we did that versus seven sets of 3. The hypertrophy was identical by the end, but the people in the powerlift, and we trained them all to failure, they were toast. They were told by the end of it, like the back pain, and like they barely could get, they did their RMs, and it was like they were happy to be able just to get through it. And like we did these exit interviews, and you wouldn't, if you just look at the data, you would have no clue of that from the data. You'd just say, hey, look, I could do, if I want to do 7 sets of 3, it's just as good as 3 sets of 10. That really is not the take home.
Right. Dude, I'm glad you brought that up, because that happened. And you even had to correct people. You're like, guys, you need to go in and actually understand what the study said. Because by the end, the guys who were doing 7 sets of 3 were absolutely wasted and didn't, like, they were just glad it was over. And the guys who were doing 3 sets of 10 were like, can we do more?
Right. And look, you could also say we trained them all to failure. Now, if I did 7 sets of 3, but we did an RIR of 1 where they were, so there's all sorts of things that could have been done. And there's the manipulation of variables, which is almost endless. You need to take those into account when you're trying to extrapolate results, as hopefully we've harped on enough for people to understand where this is.
Why I like that particular study was so, because it shows what I consider training efficiency. So if you're trying to train for mass, much better to pull back on your loading and bring your reps up, and rather than trying to work in those heavier ranges, which are more systemically and neurally taxing, than backing off the loading and getting your reps in. But that's, again, and you knew that from all the years that you were working with guys. If I want to grow, okay, look, if I'm working in the 8, 10, 12, 15 rep range, you know, I'm going to be able to do I'm not going to get as beat up from doing that work, because the loading is going to be much less.
But mechanistically, it showed that you could get roughly equal growth, at least in the biceps. So it was the only, but by the way, we actually did get leg data. It just was not, I didn't feel it was of quality, sufficient quality to publish. So I excluded it, but we did look at the legs, and what we did have, there was no difference in the legs either. Just we do what's called an ICC, interclass correlation, which looks at your reliability, and it was too low. It was below 0.7, which I did not feel was sufficient to publish those results. But what we did have showed, again, no differences, which again shows that technically you can get just as good growth from the very heavy loading. But like you said, it's not the best way to go about it.
Not if you don't want to. If you want to stay relative, like, I think that comes back to kind of overall a sense of well-being and healthiness, right? Like, because when you're beat up and your back hurts and your knees hurt and whatever, and you feel training is the last thing you want to do. And you have to kind of be in that good emotional state, right, for training too, to have optimal training too. And I think that sometimes gets overlooked, because it's not as tangible, right? Like, how do you measure that particular variable? But I think we all know when we feel good about training tends to be going better. And when we start getting beat up, we start like, I don't really think I want to go to the gym today. And that's something I feel like has to be accounted for on that individual basis kind of thing.
Well, another thing about that study people don't remember is that the bodybuilding training workout took 17 minutes. And the powerlifting training workout took 70 minutes. So that's a huge freaking time efficiency situation you got going with the bodybuilding type training. So
that would be a beautiful study upon which to base another study looking at the volume dose response relationship and this notion of neurological taxation versus muscular taxation, where you basically say, okay, so 10 sets of 3, let's see what happens when you try to do 15 sets of 3 and 20. Probably going to have dropouts. Obviously, you don't want to hurt anyone. But you could take another group, and you could have another 3 sets of 10, and then a 5 sets of 10, or 7 sets of 10, and maybe even a 10 sets of 10. and see what happens in terms of growth. You could measure, make those hormonal measurements. Look at cortisol, the basic sort of overtraining types of things. Look at muscle soreness. Look at, you know, CPK in the blood, all the things that might suggest that, you know, that something's happened in the muscle versus the nervous system. Do sleep inquiries, you know, the whole kit and caboodle. Basically try to differentiate what's going on there in terms of why you, because I'm guessing you would see different patterns in terms of the dose response in those different protocols, whereby you go above 30 reps with the 10 sets of three and you're basically, you're shitting the can right there. That's not good. That's going to be it. Whereas you can go maybe even double the volume with the lower intensity loading. And heck, if you want to like take some of the newer data that's coming, I think that study was a little bit older, but then you start doing sets of 20, you know, or sets of 20 to 30. And then you got a third group. So
too many studies, too little too time.
Yeah. So that's the thing. There's some beauty in these studies where you do a one-legged study and you train like with a higher frequency, higher volume with one, but that doesn't differentiate because you have the systemic demand is overlapping in both cases. You got
wouldn't one work in that study. Legs.
Right.
Yeah, that type of design, it's a beautiful study, beautiful design for specific studies. Anything that's going to be systemically taxing where you're looking at certain overtraining variables, it kind of wipes out that your ability to use within subject.
Right. So yeah, that's a phenomenal thing. One of the things that has been occurring to me, and you mentioned this talking about the quote unquote controversial volume study and this classic physique competitor you've been working with, who just trains like an animal, is that if you look, people sort of get mesmerized by the notion of a research study. It's like, well, they just did some sort of magical resistance training and we got like, here's the answer. So how much volume, how many sets you should do. And another way you could look at this as a smart consumer is think, and this is a function of replication, which doesn't happen as often as it probably should, is most studies, and you've done this, you've mentioned this so far in this podcast, but almost all of these studies are literally different training regimes. It's like you've got Carter training, you've got Aragon training, you've got Schoenfeld training, you've got Stevenson training, you've got thousands upon thousands of different resistance. So you would go and take, like, well, it's the John Smith training program without knowing what did John Smith do. And you take that classic physique competitor who's been training for, he's 47, I think you said, so he's been training probably a while. If you try
30 years.
30 years. So put him into the 70-minute higher volume regime, and you would probably never try to use that with something like with him, I'm guessing, with a competitor like him.
Correct.
He would get destroyed, right? So
but with Joe, I do, like I said, what we've done is selectively targeted certain body parts that were
right.
And that, again, to me, that was really the takeaway from that study. You can't extrapolate.
I'm complimenting you. That's a beautiful thing, because you created a study to answer a specific scientific question, isolating the variables, everything taken to failure, and it fits within the context of that study. That's that study. But that doesn't mean that your physique competitor guy should ever use that.
No, and no one should ever use that as a marker for their total training.
It's, right. Yes.
Again, it wasn't designed to do that for anyone. And certainly someone with Joe's, the way he would push, obviously, there's many factors you need to consider.
Yeah, and many people want to do that. It's just human nature to want to sort of boil things down. It's like, okay, you're confusing me with all this. Give me the bottom line. How many sets should I do?
By the way, to that point, too, we got the other end of it, too, because that study got a lot of play. It's funny, when I published that study, I thought the more salient, I was getting the biggest flag over the strength results. And that got a huge amount of play. We got New York Times pub for that. But the way it was brought up in the media, and of course the media wants to, you only need to work out 17 minutes to maximize, like they completely missed the boat. There's no way you can extrapolate those results either. Again, you're taking, they weren't using a strength protocol, number one, they were doing a body. So you can only extrapolate based upon what the design of the study is. And it was funny because that was I certainly was anticipating that we'd see at least some degree of a dose response for strength. At least three would get better than one, I thought.
Right.
I didn't know if the three, five would get better than three, and that didn't happen. And
you know, but that's funny. That actually, that particular part does fall in line with the Barbalo stuff that they looked at as well too, right? Was the five?
No. We showed a U curve.
No, I mean with just strength.
They showed it didn't have effects, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm gonna say that part, and that should tell a lot of guys. Okay, so from the guideline standpoint of looking at for strength increases, maybe I don't need to do a butt ton of volume. But that again is going to come back to going into the gym, and it's going to come back to how you're doing your loading. You know what your failure set point is going to look like for your sets, and how many times you're training a lift a week. Because to me, trying to get stronger, like maximally stronger for training, looks very different than it does if you're actually trying to grow maximum muscle size. And that's another area. When I was competing in powerlifting, the way I trained for powerlifting looks nothing like the way that I trained for maximal muscle growth, because one's more neurally dominated. Whereas, like, if I'm training for absolute maximal strength, I want to be as efficient and as effective in the movements as possible. So, I mean, that's what I'm going to do a lot of. So, but if I'm trying to train for muscle growth, there's a whole different kind of subset of laws that I'm going to be looking at. Whereas that they don't really play a part in strength development.
Agreed, but I think we're kind of saying the same things. You cannot extrapolate the results of our study for strength to a powerlifter. I would not say that a powerlifter just needs to do one set three times a week and they're going to maximize their lifts.
That's the area where, like, when people get in discussions with me, I'm like, I adhere to a lower volume training scheme for hypertrophy because I tend to train a lot harder. The guys that I train, I make them train much harder. And so to avoid that systemic taxation, I want that the stimulus to be high enough to cause the need for growth and adaptation. But if I'm training for a lift, then what I'm looking at is creating I want to make that movement as efficient as possible by the body. And I want to activate as many high threshold motor units as possible while not training in maximal loading. So that way, once again, I'm not getting into that systemic taxation. But in order for the body to get very efficient at performing something, you have to do quite a bit of it. Like in order to become, or most people do, there's definitely powerlifters over the years. Eddie Cohen was a really low volume guy. Kurt Kowalski was a low volume guy. I can name off tons of guys that were really low volume guys. But what I ended up settling in, which comes back to the law of individuality, was actually a more pretty much not quite high volume, but I was doing a lot more volume for my squats and my bench presses. Not as much for my deadlifts, because I've consistently found that deadlifts tend to be very systemically taxating. Especially when you move into the higher intensity ranges for loading. And that seems to be kind of pretty common for most people training. Once they get into heavy deadlifts and start doing them for reps, your recovery tends to go right into the toilet. But training wise, my training for maximal strength looked a lot like what you'd see from the Shiko Russian modalities, whereas you're doing more volume in certain blocks and you're doing it in submaximal loading with maximal speed. And that the adaptation you get there. And then, of course, you have to eventually, if you're going into a meet, you have to train a little. You have to get to where you're actually putting more weight on the bar. Your loading has to go up because the body has to have adaptation to moving. And you guys have seen that in your studies as well. Is once the loading gets up to a certain point, strength starts to climb with that as well, because there's got to be an adaptation to moving heavier loads.
Yep. And the other point you make is that the more repetitions you do over time at heavier loads leads to greater neural effects, which ultimately is what drives strength gains.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've been talking. I'm trying to make sure Scott gets a chance talking here. Like, I've just been talking. Alan got a chance. Okay, Scott, do you want to take like the second question? There are two A's, or which one do you want to tackle? Because Brad's been doing a phenomenal job.
Well, one thing, you know, we sort of touched on, which is sort of my hobby horse, people know, is, and you just mentioned it, this sort of law of individuality and biological individuality, and we don't have a ton of time, but the question that I've been formulating is, and this applies to kind of the average person. So, Brad, if someone were to say, you know, it seems like some people get away with training with lots of volume, some people, but they don't train as hard. Some people do better with higher frequency or lower frequency. Like, how would someone go about literally in the gym, and maybe even they're somewhat of an advanced competitor, making use of what we know about how and why people might respond differently to different programming parameters? What load should they use? How frequently do they train? What's the way to sort of wind your way through that to optimize your program for muscle growth?
So it's a great question. I wish I had a succinct answer I can give, but I don't think you're going to like my answer, but it's basically going to come down to using basic guidelines. And then my general, like with volume, I think you generally want to start at the lower end and then go up just from an efficiency standpoint. It doesn't make sense to start at high because then you can only go down. And to me, it's always easier to add than it is to subtract in that respect. And if you do become systemically overtrained, it's going to have greater negative ramifications than if you're just doing too low where you go up. But other things, so we're carrying out a study now, which hopefully will shed some light, where we're going to look at does fiber typing, should that be taken into account? Yeah. So should you train certain muscles with higher fiber type, higher fast twitch fibers one way versus slow twitch fibers another way? That's going to start in a month from now, so stay tuned on that. But what's the practical value? Well, unless you're going to actually fiber type or do a biopsy of all your muscles, for the soleus, I guess there are certain things you could take out of that. It's hard, you're not going to know what your fiber type is. You can look at someone and say, yeah, I think you're more fast twitch or more slow twitch there.
The low rent way of kind of the guys used for a while was figuring out like a one rep max and then doing a percentage based off
endurance.
The results based from that one rep max.
I'm not sure of the validity of that.
That's an area, it's like you just said, unless a guy's going to go out and get biopsied, I think that's kind of a nuanced area that some guys, they get paralyzed by, right? They're like, well, what's my fiber type? I'm like, unless you're going to go out and the guy's going to actually, have some testing done that shows he's, 53% more dominant, a fast twitch type than a slow twitch type in a specific area of his body. I don't know, like if he's going to change his whole training paradigm based around that, but at the same time, it'd be interesting to see if once you can figure that out, if that could be a missing link for some guys that, have hit a plateau. Cause I always say the guys that have, and you mentioned this earlier, the closer you get to your genetic ceiling is the area that if a guy's really trying to move up a notch, where those things that make a 2% difference or 3% difference, that's where all of those things start to matter. Right. For the guy that's been training for 2 or 3 years, dude, just go in and freaking train and eat good food. I mean, and you're going to grow and do that for like 10 years. And then the closer you get to that genetic ceiling, that's when things like nutrient timing start to become a little more important. And that's where things like figuring out your exact recoverable volume become far more important and those kind of things. Not that they're not important, but if you're a guy that, say, is an IFBB pro or a guy that's, that's competing at a very high level in whatever sport, overturning those little 2 and 3% things here and there become far more valuable to those guys than the gym pop guy. The guy just wants to have abs and bench 315 and look good at the beach, right? Like, that's not super difficult to achieve. But the guy that's really trying to eke out that last bit, that last 5 pounds of muscle mass over the next year, all those little 2 and 3% add up a lot for him.
You just dropped the mic, man. That's I couldn't have said that any better. That was as succinct and as well stated as I could ever do.
Add a little bit. I'm going to keep. There we go. Good. You froze up for a sec. So there's a little bit of literature. There's one of the best.
Did you hear I said that was a mic drop?
I did hear that part. And then you guys cut. Like literally, what's.
It was as succinct and as well stated as I could have ever said it. So
yeah,
thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Well, let me ask you this. This is a question I haven't found, and maybe you figured that you found this in the literature. There's a little bit in the study that comes to mind was the study with rugby players, I believe, and they looked at increase in fat free mass over the couple of years and squat strength. There's some other literature suggesting, and there's a correlation there of like maybe 0.6, something like that. I can find the study. I can't remember the first author right now, but there's a little bit of literature suggesting that those who become stronger, this course makes sense. If you look at the Barbalo plots, you see a parallel increase in strength and size. I think you see that in your study as well. There seems to be an association between getting stronger, performance enhancements in terms of one rep max and muscle growth. And I would presume, but I've never seen anyone report this study. And you have the data, as do other groups who have done the 80% versus 30 or 50% one rep max, high versus low load muscle growth studies, showing roughly about the same increase in muscle size for either approach, as long as you're taking those those low load sets to failure, which are brutal. So I'm wondering, if you look at the low load training, your performance there, you're not going to get good at a 1RM because you're not training in a heavy enough range there to do so. But if you can be someone who decides, for whatever reason, maybe they just their joints don't do well with it, or they have the sense, maybe your study will show that if you have a higher type 1 fiber myosin heavy chain composition, you're going to tend to grow better with higher reps. They decide to take that approach. Do you know of any data, or this just makes sense to me, that formal follow function, if you can go from doing 100 pounds on whatever lift for 20 reps to 200 pounds for 20 reps, you're still training in that relatively lower load, higher rep range, that is going to be sort of the best way to sort of guide your training for muscle growth, even with the low rep type of approach?
So you're saying that instead of increasing the weight, you're increasing the reps?
No, you're still stay within that, let's say, 20 to 25 rep range. But we know, for instance, you take someone who's a 200-pound bencher and you make them into a 400-pound bencher.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see that in their physique.
They've okay, got I get you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're saying if you're increasing the load at that given repetition range.
Yeah. So, would that be a good way to guide your training? It makes sense. I just haven't seen the data. It seems like such an obvious thing to report, or correlations between training performance enhancements with low load training and muscle growth with low load training. I just haven't seen any of the studies actually toss the correlation out there. And it makes sense to me that there would be one.
So I just want to make sure I understand. So you're asking that if you would you get stronger in a 1RM? If you increase your load from, let's say, at 20 reps from 200 pounds to 400 pounds, is that what you're asking?
No. Pretty much, if you train with a 80% one rep max, you train mm-hmm. with heavy loads, you're going to improve your one rep max much more so than if you train with light loads. We're doing 20 to 30 reps. That's right. Pretty certain. That's specificity of training exemplified.
Yep.
So you wouldn't expect necessarily that a one rep max estimate, it would be a good predictor of growth when you're not training in a way that tends to increase the one rep max.
Right.
Let's say you're someone in the trenches who says, you know, I think I need to use higher reps. And so your average guy who just wants to have a big bench and a big squat, they're going to get big by getting stronger in those with those heavier loads. But what about the guy who wants to take the higher rep approach? Could they say, you know what, I'm not quite sure what to do here. Maybe I'm going to start logging my weight. I'm going to start paying it. I'm going to stick in those higher rep ranges. And I'm going to try to get ridiculously good at progressing in a performance way, using heavier loads, but still loads that I can use for the 20 to 25 rep range. And my question is kind of two-part. Like, one, I've never seen anyone report a correlation between – because you have the training data, obviously it's there because you're guiding those people, you know how many reps they're doing, and you're moving their loads up. That seems like a great thing to correlate and see to what extent you can explain the variance in muscle growth with the variability in increased loads used in the higher rep ranges, the lower percentage of one rep max. And then if that's the case, that would point to the training strategy of, well, if I'm going to train quote-unquote light, but take things to failure and train hard with a relative high effort, I can't just keep doing, like, if I go from 100 to 120 pounds over 2 years, I wouldn't necessarily expect that I'm going to get that much bigger. But if I go from 100 to 200 pounds, 20 reps with 100 pounds to 20 reps with 200 pounds, that's impressive. You've just doubled the load. So that's what I was kind of, I probably kind of answered my own question, but I wanted to get your insights and input on it.
I think you did, and I think the interesting thing when we're talking about strength and hypertrophy correlations, so we actually published a paper on this. It was headed by a really great researcher named Andrew Bogoski. He's a colleague of mine, does a lot of my statistical analysis, and he did a statistical modeling that was just really incredible. But we looked at we got data from another group on where they did weekly strength testing and weekly muscle testing. And what we found was that from a correlation standpoint, you have to look at the measure that you're of hypertrophy. So certain measures, if you're just doing a muscle thickness measure versus a muscle cross-sectional area versus a muscle volume, at least this is for the lower body, for the legs, They all give different correlations. So there was multiple factors. When we're just looking, we would think that a single point estimate on of a muscle, let's say the quadriceps, if you look at the vastus lateralis and look at its thickness,
regional growth.
The squat, yeah, the squat is a three joint movement. You know, your ankle, your knee, and your hip joints are moving in a coordinated fashion, and it's just much more complex. And if you're not measuring, number one, the muscle changes at all these muscles, and not taking into account of the neural factors, very hard to start drawing good correlations with the limited, with just a one sample of muscle tissue. Mm.
But in that analysis, when you looked at those three different ways of measuring muscle size changes, was mm-hmm. there a significant correlation, or at least a practically meaningful correlation between strength and gains in muscle mass?
Oh, yeah. But it was when you looked at the muscle volume. There's a bunch of things. I can actually, if you're able to post, I can link that study up to you. People should read it more than we can get into at this point. But there were some complexities. But, yeah, there definitely was. But you needed a higher modeling. And the statistical analysis that's used, it was really important, too. So there's other factors. You can do all sorts of statistical approaches and come up with no variance. We actually showed this. We did these three different, or I think four or five different modelings. And one of them showed, like, no correlation. And the highest level modeling showed a moderate to high correlation. It's like, R value was close to 0.6, if I recall, which is a pretty decent correlation. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's the interesting thing. A reason I'm asking this question is, you'll see, like, for instance, when the press will take the idea of, well, you only need to train 17 minutes or however long the shortest, that lowest volume group trained for, but they neglected to put you get to train to failure, which you go to the gym and you don't see many people training to failure. And then, of course, that doesn't mean you could go in and just train 17 minutes and do the same thing again and again and again. And really, like, we can go through all the machinations of, should we train, you know, twice or three times a week or five times a week or just compound movements or isolation movements. But if you look over the long haul, over 5 years, of someone who's made measurable, demonstrable visual improvements in their physique from a muscular perspective, someone who's got some muscle mass to show from their efforts, those are the ones I tend to find. This is just sort of you know, this is what you go into the gym, it's an ecological perspective, but those are the ones who are doing impressive stuff in the gym. You can tell, by either they're trained really hard, they may pick up, you know, they may do a 185-pound bench press, but they're banging out 25 reps. Or they're really, really strong. So that's the thing, that's why I ask about, you know, if what over sort of an umbrella concept is this form follows function idea. And that's one of the things that I don't see addressed, like, for instance, the correlational data with the low load training. It's like, so the low load training works. We know that now. If you train hard to failure, but does it work if you just keep doing the same thing? Well, no, that's, you don't have any progressive overload. So that was sort of the point. So I'd love to see I'd love to see a publication. I'd love to see you put that data out, you know, somewhere, you know, because I know you have it. It's there in your spreadsheets, I'm sure.
We do. I will. I have to go back and look at that data. But you actually also brought up something I think that I did want to address, which I think is really important about the failure aspect. And just this is anecdotally, but and there's certainly no data. I talked about the paucity of data in high level, certainly bodybuilders. But to me, we don't have any anything that I don't have anything to hang my hat on evidence wise, except anecdotal evidence. That the higher you go, I think the more important it is to train to failure at least some of the time in your training. All the high-level bodybuilders that I've worked with have at least to some degree trained not only to failure, but really the effort that the type of failure training they do is above what the average Joe is. Guys like Joe, who I'm training now, John Meadows, and from what I gather, you do as well. I know Alan is just a beast.
My and Scott's motto is train or die. So basically, when we're in the gym, it's we trained together down in Tampa, and we were just trying to figure out ways to torture one another. And I think that's a really, like, that's such a great point, Brad, that I think a lot of guys need to get. It's like the closer you get to that genetic ceiling, the harder it becomes to stimulate more growth. Which means adding more volume, or, you know, just like at some point you're going to have to train really freaking hard.
At some point you break out the cattle prod.
Yeah, because I don't like, and that's the thing. And maybe a part of that is because I've been training for 30 years, and that's what I've always known. Was I was like, okay, so when you know, coming up, if you're coming up in the 90s, you know, Dorian was king. So the emphasis during that time was, man, you better train your ass off if you want to grow. And that kind of has, when you train with a high level of effort, a really high level of effort, then that's going to have, that's going to end up dictating your volume and your frequency kind of naturally if you're paying attention to those signals. And I think that's why, like, I kind of work from that particular area a lot, is that because I've been at this so long, it's like you talked about, if you take a bunch of guys that don't have much experience, you know, is if they just train relatively hard, they can still grow. But then as you create more and more and more and more adaptions over time, your body gets like, nah, I got this, man. You've been doing this a while.
And yeah, the basic principle of adaptation is that you have to challenge your body beyond what it's used to doing. And right. How you do that is you keep getting higher. That means you're going to have to use more. You have to do something that is going to challenge it. It could be shortening your rest. It could be more volume. But I think the one practical tool that we have, and it's just anecdotally been shown in bodybuilders, is that training harder is at least one of the primary factors that needs to be utilized if you're going to continue to make gains over time.
Yeah, and you brought up a point about it, because I've trained with Meadows on a number of occasions, and it's the same thing. Anytime us bros get together like that, you know, it becomes a little bit of a dick measuring session, not about weight lifted, and that's what a lot of guys don't get. It's not necessarily about who's got the most, but it's who's going to go the hardest in the paint.
Right.
It really is. It's going to be who's going to show up who's, like who trained the hardest that day. And I really feel like that's what a lot of guys these days that are frustrated with progress, they're not grasping, is that maybe it's time that they just start training a bit harder than they have been training in order to create that need for adaptation at a level they just not got to. But to tie that in with what Scott just said, we're running low on time. I wanted to make, because I feel like this was an important point. If you're not getting any stronger, if you're lifting 200 pounds for 10 reps today, and 6 months from now you're lifting 200 pounds for 10 reps, you're probably not going to have much muscle growth that have happened in that span. And a lot of guys that get stuck on these, all these different modalities and ideologies about training, sometimes it comes back. And I've had that particular conversation with a lot of other advanced guys too, is that we get into those modes too, where we want to try fancy stuff and do this and do that. And then you get stuck for a while and like, oh yeah, like I'm not lifting anything more right now than I was like a year ago. And then when you kind of pair things back and go, let me get stronger for a while again, and then you blow up, and a lot of guys think it's because of drugs or whatever. A lot of times, I'm telling you, us advanced guys, we do the same thing. We're like, let's go do this for a while and do that for a while, experiment. And then we're like, wow, like I really haven't seen any amazing results for the past 6 months. And you're like, I'm really not any stronger. And then once you kind of pair it back to do the basics again with the principles that we know, regardless of anything else, work 100% of the time. If I take my squat from 315 to 10 reps to 500 for 10 reps over whatever period of time, my legs are going to be bigger. Like, there's no way around that.
Nope.
And by the way, I think kind of to your point too, it goes to to support at least a logical rationale for periodization, because if you're just constantly training at a high level, then the body is constantly getting the same stimulus. If you wave it so that you're in some periods, you bring it down, then you bring it up, that's how you're going to keep taking your body out. So you look to not regress, but you look to plateau, you know, you look to keep it and then go up. You never are going to progress when you start to get to the level of you guys.
Yeah. And that's another point. Yeah. It's like, no matter what your training modality is, there has to be some form of periodization implemented into it, whether your effort or your perceived intensity, or whether you're periodizing your loading or all the above, however you're doing, there's got to be some form of periodization in there that's happening throughout the year to not only give this, like, to recover systemically if you've been training either high volume or high effort for a while, but to create that new novel stimulus that you're going to need each time to move up a little bit. But you almost have to have, it's like you said, it's not a regression, but like periods of where you're going to create that next phase of training that introduce that novel stimulus that you had to create adaptation to. So it's like you literally have to have periods where you're not progressing in order to progress later.
Completely agree.
Yeah. So, which is that's hard to get your mind around, but you almost have to have periods where you're like, I'm just going to go maintain. And I've even seen where guys, where I pull them back and they go into maintenance mode and they grow, because what happens is all of a sudden the adaptations get revealed through the rest. And that's what you kind of look at through the whole overreaching and supercompensation too. It's like the adaptations already happened, but they get revealed later after the rest has actually happened.
Yep.
So
thank you for this. Appreciate it very much. Especially
my pleasure, guys. Really enjoyed it. Hopefully the audience does as well.
Yeah. There's so much.
We only got through like a third of the questions we had.
Scratched the surface. Yeah.
Yeah, I think
Alan, if you just kept talking too much, that was the problem. You know, it dominated the conversation, and it.
I apologize to both of you guys for I totally felt like I dominated the conversation, but Brad would just say something, and my head would just start going. But I hope everybody enjoyed it. Brad, like, can't thank you enough for coming on. I know you're a busy guy, running all over the world and not doing all your seminars and stuff. Tell everybody who's watching where they can find you. That's like the other thing. I know Google is one place. Like if they Google Brad Schoenfeld, they'll probably find you, my man.
That's probably the best way. Yeah, but I have a website that's called lookgreatnaked.com. I have a blog, but I'm all over social media. I focus on Instagram, Twitter, and I've kind of tooled back my Facebook because the algorithms suck now. They're brutal, but I still do some Facebook as well. And you just search me and you'll find me.
Yeah, dude, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Such an amazing discussion. I wish we could have had about 8 hours to have gotten into to
everything. Do it again, man.
Yeah, because the synergy was really good. Next time, come back on with us, man, so we can cover
some
of the other stuff in this. I'll shut up the next time so that way Alan and Scott can talk more. Alan butchered the first question. After that, I was just
freaking Barbalo. A damn RCT, not a meta-analysis. He did two of them.
All right. Brad, we'll let you get on with your day. Like I said, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I thought it was an incredibly stimulating discussion, man. All of us appreciate your work and your research that you do. I know all of us have used it at some point or another in articles or stuff that we've done for citations. So keep on doing the good work, man. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Brad.
I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Until next time, we are the Swoley Trinity.
Peace out.
Peace out, guys.
Adios.
All right.